Stunned silence.
What is
this? A little bit of an
So I must be doing something, right?
And it's playing some sort of thing.
Tell us what you mean.
I just can't think of it.
I love the enthusiasm.
Cool.
You're tuned to The 15th Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 166 for September 2021. I'm your host, James, and in the virtual rendition studios tonight, we've got Gavin. How are you, Gavin?
Good, thanks, James. Happy September.
Happy September to you, my friend. Good to talk to you, and always great to talk to the wonderful Anna. How are you, Anna?
I am well, thank you. I'm enjoying springtime.
Springtime in Canberra.
Lovely.
Oh, lovely. Very good. And enjoying springtime a little bit closer to me here in Auckland is the one, the only, the Don. How are you, Don?
Terrible. It's lockdown. It sucks.
It's lockdown. That's right. Since last we recorded our podcast a month ago, because it would be the 15th. In fact, we were just sitting here, sitting pretty, weren't we, in New Zealand, thinking, oh, lockdown's really feeling for everyone around the world. And then in a show of solidarity, we decided to join you. And then, as has been pointed out, we decided to ramp things up because when we do lockdowns, we take it very serious. So, yes, we're recording this podcast from level 4 lockdown here in Auckland, week number, what are we up to, Don? 4? Must be. Going into week number 4.
Into the fifth week, so this is officially the longest lockdown in New Zealand history.
Yeah, right, there you go. So we've been locked down basically since the last episode and still in lockdown. And for our international listeners, when we say lockdown, I have a couple of tests when I talk to friends and colleagues around the world, and they go, oh, you know, lockdown. And, you know, Australia, obviously, because Canberra's in lockdown as well. And
yes.
We were just talking in the pre-show. I've got a couple of tests to see how serious your lockdown is. Can you get a takeaway coffee?
Yes.
Ah. Can you do click and collect from a store like Bunnings, which is a hardware store?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. You're not as locked down as we are then, are you? Are butcheries and bakeries open?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. This feels like Jeff Foxworthy. You might be a redneck, or your lockdown might be strict if.
Yeah, you're not in lockdown until. Yes. So. Yeah. Oh well, we have an in principle agreement that apparently next week, if everything's looking well and the vaccines keep going, then Auckland will drop. The rest of the country is in level 2.
Two point something.
Schools open. Got to wear masks. But no, Auckland. Here we are. Still stuck in it. So let's see if we can get into some stories to take our minds off our lockdown. Let's look at this first one from the NZ Catholic. New Zealand's Catholic bishops have condemned a terrorist attack that took place in an Auckland supermarket on September the 3rd, in which 7 people were injured. A knife-wielding militant was shot dead by police. The bishops issued a short statement on the 4th of September about the attack on innocent people in the Countdown Lynn Mall supermarket in West Auckland. Quote, to those who have been injured, we hold you in our prayers and pray for your recovery. We are deeply saddened, and our hearts go out to you, your whānau, and the wider affected communities, the bishops wrote. 7 people were injured and 6 were admitted to hospitals. 2 were in a critical but stable condition in Auckland Hospital on the 5th of September, and 1 other was in a critical but improving condition. The others had been discharged from hospital by the 6th of September. Authorities are not looking for anyone else in connection with the attack. The bishops wrote that, quote, we are conscious the perpetrators of such terror attacks always seek to divide communities as much as to inflict direct violence on individuals. We know that the actions of this one extremist are his crimes alone. The Catholic community of Aotearoa, New Zealand, stands with people of all faiths and alongside people who profess no faith as a people united against violence in every form. Yes, terrible situation that happened at the start of the month. Gavin, did you get much coverage of it over there in Australia? What was your sort of take? I'll just start by stating for any of our new listeners. Oh, welcome, by the way. Welcome, all new listeners. We won't be mentioning the names, the name of terrorists, because just no point giving them any extra glory. But it is worth talking about their victims and talking about the attack. So yeah, keen to get an understanding, Gavin, what it was like across the ditch. Did you get much commentary on this?
Yeah, in fact, the first I knew about it was an alert from Australian media. I get a few of those into my inbox every day, and it came across. So yeah, I mean, initial reaction, you know, you sort of, your mind goes back to the situation in Christchurch 2.5 years ago, pretty quickly, and thankfully this wasn't on the same scale, and certainly not didn't have the fatalities that the Christchurch mosque shooting had. But there were a number of people who were injured, as you mentioned there. The police had been following this gentleman, well, probably not the right word, this person, because he was on watch lists, and that's probably what saved the lives, or certainly serious injury for a number of other people, because within about 60 seconds, I understand, he was apprehended by police who were tailing him, fearing that he might do something like this. So, it's been a... It was a sad thing. It was a, different, but, in another stabbing in another supermarket in New Zealand, I think earlier this year, down in Dunedin, that probably didn't garner as much attention because it was seemed to be, as in this case, a individual who was obviously had some issues. These seemed to be terrorist motivated. The other was more mental health, I understand. But, so it's the second such attack, albeit with different motivations and different results in New Zealand in the last few months. So it does, I guess, show how our safety, and it's something we've been talking about a lot in the last 18 months in terms of safety from a pandemic, but how our safety from people who wish to do us harm is reasonably brittle. You know, these things can seemingly happen quite quickly. So... it's a challenge, and obviously in this case, when they were following somebody and knew that he posed a risk, we can look and say, well, this is an issue that needs to be addressed. But there are people who can commit horrible crimes without being on radars and without there really being any chance to try and stop it from happening. So certainly the bishops spoke out well, I think, in understanding that these sorts of acts are individuals who seem to have a distortion of what it is they think they believe, it's always, there's something about being in across the Tasman and Australia when things like this happen in New Zealand. It makes you feel quite distant, I guess, and away from some of the challenges happening there.
Yeah, I mean, it really was terrible. And I think it's one of those things where it was a surreal. Well, I mean, I say surreal. I don't know what isn't surreal nowadays when it comes to the news coverage of these things. But Anna, what about you? I mean, obviously being away from home, but hearing about this, what were your sort of thoughts at the time when you heard about it?
Oh, like Gavin, I sort of had that, the Christchurch shootings in my head, and I think by the time I sort of found out about it, I think it was all over. But still, it's terrifying that this sort of mundane, sort of daily or weekly event can become, a place of violence and fear, and for some people. And I have to say, I've sort of followed a little bit of the articles about the perpetrator, and since then, and because he did have a particular affiliation with a terrorist group, but he was an immigrant, a refugee, and I think he just had no one. And I'm not making excuses for his actions, but sometimes people are so adrift from any kind of stable reality or a safe community where they feel that they belong. And that has disastrous consequences. Now, not everyone necessarily becomes a terrorist, but, people have mental health issues. Like that whole... It's made me really think about the importance of, being in a community of some kind, and whether it's, people from the country that you were born in, or people who share your same religion, or just, your neighborhood or whatever, how important that is for each of us to be a well-rounded and sane person. And, you know, in light of us all being in lockdown, I'm certainly sort of feeling the distance from other people in my community. But I, at least I know I still have one there, and, you know, you can tap into it to a certain degree. But for people who don't have that and then end up finding their community in an organization that is all about hatred and the destruction of people, it's actually really sad. And again, I don't condone anything that he did. I feel like, you know, perhaps there was a possibility with him that maybe we could have the wider community, we could have done something, reached out or whatever. I don't know. We always say that after these events, right? But, yeah. You know, these people are in our community right now. And, you know, what are we doing to reach out to them and to help them see that each person has a dignity and their life is precious and, you know, to uphold that.
Yeah, particularly when we know that this person is like this, right? When the authorities knew that this person was a great danger to other people.
And there were a few people from a couple of imams who had reached out while he was in jail and tried, but unfortunately... I think there was not great communication between the Department of Corrections and so he slipped through the cracks. Mm. So there was an attempt made, and there's some people from, you know, the wider Islamic community who are saying we were here and we wanted to help and we didn't get that opportunity. Mm. It's a tragedy because he lost his life, and praise God he didn't kill anybody. But his life is gone, and he's forever known as a terrorist now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really good point. Oh, well, it's all good points you raise, and the one particularly around isolation. And I just wonder, you know, obviously as we're all, you know, in different stages of lockdown, and the world continues to be that way, and the longer that we deal with you know, the pandemic, there is increasing talk about what that means for people who are isolated and become even more so. And I'm not saying this contributed to this situation, but I am saying that the ongoing consideration for how we avoid people feeling isolated, being disconnected, particularly when they are in a situation where they're more susceptible to radicalization or just being, you know, alone. That can exacerbate issues. What about you, Don? What did you think of this, mate?
I'm going to take a bit of a different tack to,
go
to
on,
Anna,
go on then.
And
mix things up.
Yeah, mix things up a little bit. I guess if you look at some of the detail and some of the history, and yes, there were mental illness issues, but even in the mental illness. If you look at some of the stuff that he was looking at on the internet, and it's basically, you know, people being beheaded and celebrating that kind of thing from kind of militant ISIS groups. He was stopped at the border looking to fight in at the border of Auckland Airport, and looking to go to Syria to fight for ISIS. There's a barrage of kind of internet materials that he was surfing. There is something innate in us as human beings, even in that mental illness, to say this isn't right. You know, we shouldn't be celebrating humans being decapitated. This is inherently, there's something very wrong about this, even in the mental illness. So I don't really buy the excuse around mental illness, because we all have this innate kind of sense of morality that's been given to us by God, and we know right from wrong. And yeah, I think there was an opportunity at different stages of his life to basically say, no, this is absolutely wrong. This is not our ideology. Yeah, yes, I'm hurting, or yes, there are some things that I can't control, or that I'm angry about. But there are, I just don't buy in that there are not these opportunities to basically self-reflect and say, this is absolutely evil. So, yeah, I'm just not as compassionate and, from that respect. And I guess, a reflection on the government of the day. Like, he's assaulted a security guard to, while in prison. He's served a year in prison. He's not a New Zealand national. He's been followed since 2016. There's all the reason, had 30 people following him, so all the resources associated with that. And basically the Prime Minister threw up her hands and said, I was basically hand-tied by the law, which isn't true because she's the chief legislator and she rams through under urgency laws like getting prisoners to vote, the most liberal abortion laws in the West. So she can ram those through under urgency, but she's basically had since 2016, so that's when she's known about this individual, and she hasn't done anything from a legislative basis since 2016. So this is an individual who's known as a danger, and has had people basically following him, and the fact that we can't either keep him in incarceration or deport him is an absolute indictment. And basically the PM had a responsibility to keep New Zealanders safe, and that there's 5 people who have been stabbed, and thank God they weren't that they weren't killed as a result of this administration's incompetence.
Well, I mean, it's okay. The administration's incompetence. Mic drop at the end there. I quite like that, Don. I think the point, I mean, let's not put two bones about it. His mental health aside, the acts that he undertook absolutely were abhorrent and evil and wrong. And I think that looking at the lead up to it, I do think you've got a good point there around I had a similar reaction when I read about we're hamstrung by the law. It's like, well, you do write the law and you have shown... you're able to rewrite laws quite quickly in other areas, and I'm sure they will be working on it now. I think it's a terrible situation no matter which way you cut it. We do pray for the quick healing of the victims. But I would also, I think I would encourage all to add to our prayer petitions. We had a bit of an internet outage actually this month as well. We've had some denial of service attacks hitting New Zealand. Like, could you time some of those internet outages? I'm trying to think who the patron saint of the internet is. Saint Isidore, isn't it? I should pray for Saint Isidore's intercession that the timed internet outages, if we're going to have them, are for when people like this are searching for that kind of material online. That's a good time to give an internet outage, I think. Kind of keep people away from some of the rubbish that's on there when they don't really have a conscience to hold them back in. Speaking of conscience, our next story from the Courier Mail. Faith-based healthcare providers are warning Queensland state politicians that unless euthanasia laws are changed to protect their right to offer services in line with their values, staff could suffer psychological harm. Under proposed laws, hospitals and other healthcare providers will be powerless to stop euthanasia taking place in their facilities, regardless of whether their organisation and their staff have fundamental objections to the practice. No other state has already passed euthanasia laws, including Victoria, Tasmania, South Australia, or Western Australia, has included the measure. St. Vincent's Health Australia Chief Executive Toby Hall said their doctors and nurses were completely shocked at the notion they might be forced to witness euthanasia taking place in their workplace. Wendy Ruhan, a palliative care nurse at St. Vincent's private hospital in Brisbane, said she was extremely anxious about the prospect that euthanasia may take place in her workplace, and pleaded with the state's politicians to reconsider that section of the bill. She said she didn't believe consideration had been given to the psychological impact of the practice of euthanasia in the workplace would have on staff at faith-based facilities. Ms. Ruhan said, although she would never judge someone's choice to use euthanasia, she believed she deserved the right not to have her values compromised in this way. This one, Anna, I mean, is quite... like the idea that there isn't any kind of protection for people who work in faith-based care to this, well, what was your take on this one?
Oh, I mean, it's pretty terrible. But at the same time, I'm not surprised that this is now coming in, because especially in Australia, there are a lot of faith-based hospitals, Catholic hospitals in particular. And so I think they tend to be a bit of a sticking point in these various moves by state governments to, you know, legalize euthanasia and abortion and other things of that sort. And so I'm sort of unfortunately not surprised that Catholic hospitals are sort of feeling the pinch, I suppose. And, you know, it's, I kind of understand it, because from their point of view, from the point of view of those who advocate for euthanasia, from their point of view, it is, you know, we're doing the right thing. We are, you know, this isn't killing somebody. This is setting them free or taking away their pain or whatever it might be. And, you know, I don't think they really think about the cost to the person who actually has to, you know, do the injection or do the procedure or whatever that happens in order to kill somebody. So, yeah, it's just a really bad situation. And to be fair, I was surprised. I know that in the other states that have already passed euthanasia laws, I thought that they might have things in place that if you didn't want to participate in that kind of treatment, and I'm using my fingers as quotation marks, but that you could, you know, opt out. But then I did think that that would slowly get eroded over time. And I think if Queensland pass the law as it is, then those other states will, I think, make adjustments as they see fit as well. So I think it's part of the slippery slope, you know?
Indeed. It's slippery slope, but the very definition of it, yeah. Don, what about you, mate? Do you think there should be provisions to protect people who work in faith-based care, that they don't have to have this happen in their workplace?
Yeah, absolutely, and the provisions are in place, and even even Victoria, which is often regarded as the most kind of liberal state in Australia. So, if those provisions are in place in Victoria, not Queensland, that does seem pretty odd to me. I think the Catholic hospitals and the faith-based hospitals basically need to band together and basically play chicken on this one, and basically you know, threaten to shut up shop. I know when the American faith-based hospitals and institutions have been in a similar spot, that they've basically banded together and threatened to shut up shop. So yeah, maybe if they band together and do a similar thing here, then the government will back down.
Did that work for them in the US?
It did work for them in the US, yeah.
Because, I mean, that's the point, right? Like, as you sort of said, Anna and Gavin, I mean, there are a lot of faith-based care facilities in Australia. Definitely not as many in New Zealand, but maybe that would work. I don't know. Gavin, what do you make of it, mate?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there's been quite a lot of strong lobbying to that effect. The Queensland government enjoyed a reasonably large victory at the last election, so they are feeling pretty bolshy about things. And it appears that a number of politicians from the more conservative side of the parliament are planning to vote for it as well. I think it's tomorrow, the 16th, I think, is when the legislation is expected to pass. So there has been a fair bit of quite prominent, you know, front pages of newspapers, the biggest newspapers in Queensland and that sort of thing, about the request for this to be allowed. At the moment, as I say, we're sort of on the eve of the vote. It appears that this amendment won't get up, there's still a chance that it might, but it is another step along the path to not only allowing something that we would consider a moral evil to happen, but also not giving people the opportunity to opt out if they don't want to be involved. When Anna was talking about the idea of, you know, a doctor has to do, you know, this particular act to bring about this particular outcome, I was thinking, I think I'm right in saying that back in the days when, you know, firing squads and all that sort of thing, when they were going to kill somebody, they'd have, you know, a number of people so they wouldn't know who actually was responsible for killing the person. In this instance, the doctor is going to know that they were responsible for bringing about the death of somebody. So back when we had firing squads, there seemed to be a sense that, oh, we don't want this burden to lay with somebody when they, in the eyes of the law, at least were killing somebody who the law said was justifiably to be killed. But we don't want someone to, you know, feel bad that they actually fired the bullet that killed somebody. Yet here we are, the doctor is going to know that he or she has brought about this outcome, and there's even a chance that they will have to do that against their own will.
I mean, I might be misreading it, Gavin, you'll be closer to the story than I am, but are they saying that people will need to undertake this? Like, the way I was reading it was, there might be doctors working in Catholic institutions who are okay with euthanasia, which would kind of be weird, but, you know, that they might be, and it's that other people don't like the idea that it's taking place, or someone comes in from outside to perform the procedure, but people don't like the fact that that might be happening in the hospital, or is it more that people will be forced to actually give the procedure?
I suspect it's pretty unlikely that an individual will be forced to carry out the act themselves, but there may be circumstances where that is the case. But, you know, not everywhere is a large city where there's, you know, large hospitals with dozens or hundreds of doctors. So there is the potential for something like that to happen if this legislation passes as drafted. So I think, you know, Anna mentioned the slippery slope. There's always unintended consequences, or pretty much always unintended consequences of any legislation. And one of them may be that doctors who themselves object because of the circumstance of their particular health service location or personnel or whatever, that they might at least feel like there's no chance, and the law might tell them that there's no chance for them to opt out. So, and I think, yeah, even knowing it's going on in your own facility, if you're someone like the nurse that you mentioned there, that would have its own effect on people being in, you know, involved in an organization that's having to do that, even though the organization doesn't want to. I think to Don's point, I'm hopeful that this isn't going to become a situation where Catholic and other faith-based organizations have to do what they don't want to do, but
the slippery slope, but Anna said, continues down that path.
My understanding of the legislation is that the individual doesn't, like, if you're a doctor and you don't want to participate, that you don't have to, but you do have to allow someone from the outside, for a patient who has opted for that option, to come in.
Right, yeah, that's how I sort of read it as well, which, you know, it's the start, right? It's the start, and then where does it go from there? Right, well, let's move on to our next story. This one is from Scoop. Wellington Catholic Social Services is seeking rental accommodation for refugee families from Afghanistan who will be resettling in Wellington. Right now we need urgent help, says Karen Holland from Wellington Catholic Social Services. We are desperate to find rental housing for the Wellington-bound families over the next few weeks. Stable housing is crucially important to help these people to adjust and settle well into their lives ahead. So our call is to all parish communities to help. We are also seeking basic furniture and household packs for the families, including bed linen, towels, kitchen utensils, and pantry items such as rice, cooking oils, canned or black or kidney beans, tea and coffee, etc. Every action, small or large, will greatly benefit the individuals and families fleeing a desperate situation and seeking safety in New Zealand. Together we can help these people to settle well in the Wellington region. By the end of August, more than 20,000 people in New Zealand had signed a petition asking the government to bring more Afghan refugees to New Zealand. Yes, of course, since our last episode, there's also been the I don't know, Don, what would you call it? The somewhat not orderly withdrawal from Afghanistan and the subsequent crisis that has created. What do you make of the call here from Catholic Social Services in Wellington for help?
I probably have some words that I probably cannot say online, but
we are rated family friendly. Yes. Let's keep us that.
But it's a complete mess, and basically, the Biden administration was basically put themselves on a timeline to be able to basically parade around at the 20th anniversary of 9/11 and say that they've gone out of Afghanistan, which is absolutely immoral. So it's basically a PR stunt that you've put people at risk. Yeah, you basically had 13 servicemen, US servicemen, that died on one day, and the countless of other Afghans who have also died. Like, it's basically in the hundreds. And then, you know, you've still got Americans stranded there, and you've got a whole bunch of people basically in the 20-year war. You've got a whole bunch of Afghanis who helped the kind of allied forces. And even though the Taliban have promised not to take retribution against these people, I don't think you can basically take the word for it. And there's basically, yeah, there has been evidence of them slaughtering those who have helped the administration. And you know, there's numerous examples of that taking place. So we absolutely have a moral obligation to help these Afghani refugees and take as many as can, especially those, you know, the New Zealand Defence Force was a participant in a lot of those. So, yeah, I think we have a moral obligation specifically to those individuals that helped the NZDF over there, and to help those families, you know, immediately. But what an absolute mess for a PR stunt. It's absolutely diabolical, and I'm no friend of the Democrats, as you probably know from previous episodes. But this just adds another string in their bow for the cause for a resignation. If Biden had any morals or any conscience, he'd resign yesterday.
Right. Well, I think that's probably unlikely. I'm just sort of still reeling from the news that you don't have a soft spot for the Democrats. I obviously haven't been paying attention for the last 14 years or so. But I think you make some really, really good points. I mean, I think that, you know, the call from the Catholic Social Services for help is spurred on by the fact that we're going to have more refugees coming to New Zealand. I think the Australian situation, Gavin, is the call's been put out to take in more than they have in the past. It would just be a better situation if there weren't refugees to take at all, right? But what was your sort of take on this, on the call, on the end to the war, on the upgrade of to the Taliban's weapons? I mean, what was your sort of take on things, mate?
Yeah, I mean, I think I might just speak to the Australian context and the efforts from a number of church leaders, including the Catholic bishops, but the other denominations as well, to increase the intake. The government essentially committed to an extra 3,000 Afghan refugees, and a number of groups, including the Catholic bishops, have called for that to be increased to 20,000. So it's quite a significant increase, and, you know, there's been some people saying there's plenty of people to look after in our own backyard. Why would we worry about people from another country, which is, you know, probably a very much a nationalistic and self-centered attitude to take, given particularly the points Don's made around the fact that the Australian Defence Force, again, was part of that coalition that was there, interpreters, translators, those sorts of people who supported them, that were left very vulnerable. There was, in Australia, they talked about, I think, 700 that had been seeking to get visas to come to Australia, and I think a very small number, as in like 150 or 200, I think, had been successful, and others not. There's hopefully been a few more that have been allowed in. But I think one of the interesting things about this is, you know, by and large, the people in Afghanistan are going to be people who are Muslim. And I think I read somewhere there's only 200 Catholics, I think, and there were 200 Catholics in Afghanistan. and there was one Catholic church, which was at the Italian embassy. So I'd read that in one of the Christian publications. But 10 years ago, I mean, and earlier, back in the 1990s, the governments in certainly New Zealand and in Australia supported the arrival and the refugee status of a number of people from the Middle East who were Christians and were being persecuted there. I think there's something particularly noble about the bishops taking such a strong stance when, you know, and I'm not saying it was self-serving to bring in Christians from the Middle East, but certainly you could say, well, you know, it would be understandable that the churches, the Christian churches, would want to bring in people who were being persecuted in the Middle East because they were Christians. There's an added layer of, you know, who is my brother when you're bringing in people who are Muslims but are being persecuted for all sorts of other reasons in Afghanistan. So it's unclear where somewhere between 3,000 and 20,000 the number might fall, but certainly Christian organizations and others as well, obviously Muslim organizations and other sort of human rights groups have led the charge and have offered practical support in terms of if refugees came from Afghanistan, that the Catholic community would support them in finding housing and support and other things to help them find a new life in Australia. And I think that's the point that Wellington's Catholic Social Services are making, that there's an obligation to support people who are trying to make a new life, particularly when they're escaping a regime that we know has a history of women and children in particular, but also people who don't fit within their understanding of Islam. They can be very susceptible to attack and death. So I think it's important that the Christian churches have spoken up on this, and can only hope that their advocacy might prove fruitful.
Yeah, I mean,
so just the extra layer of geopolitics of that. So the U.S. administration has basically excluded taking the refugees of you know, who are Christians, so that adds an extra layer of responsibility and complexity to the other countries to take some of those Christian refugees.
Interesting. There's definitely an element of, you know, to those who much has been given, much will be asked, and it's times like this where I'm very grateful that I live where I live, even if I don't really have much of a choice because I can't leave. But that's not the point. The point is that, you know, when you've got people who have in such incredible, desperate situations, and, you know, we can talk about how much of that has been created or not by geopolitical environment, Anna, you've still got such desperate need, and the need for the world and, you know, our part of the world to step up and do our part.
Absolutely. Look, it's good that both of our countries are, you know, making efforts to well, certainly various groups in our countries, efforts to you know, bring people who are in need over here. And I was just thinking, though, with the whole New Zealand situation, like with the housing crisis, I was reading something the other day, like that the number of people without adequate housing or proper homes has like more than doubled, you know, in the last sort of year or so. And while I'm totally like, you know, great, bring refugees, how many can we, you know, like, I'm just like, well, we can barely house the people that are already in New Zealand. And so it really falls to our government to really make some better decisions around that, because it's been something that's been ongoing for a long time. And, you know, it's kind of like a bit of a roundabout, like our first story with talking about the, you know, the immigrant, or the refugee who came to New Zealand and then ended up, you know, under the influence, I suppose, of a terrorist group and did atrocities. And maybe part of that was because he just couldn't get in to, for whatever reason, you know, into the society, into the community. And, you know, rightly so, the article points out that having, you know, adequate housing and, you know, a community around them is really important for their integration into their new home. And so there's many people who work in that area and they know what they need. And I think the government just needs to be listening more carefully and to those people who know what they're talking about, and make things happen, like make housing happen. Stop making decisions that end up reducing the, you know, number of housing opportunities for people who are really struggling. And, you know, because the refugees who come will possibly be in the same boat without work or, you know, things like that. So, you know, they've just made some really poor decisions over the last couple of years or since they've been in power. And maybe it's an ongoing thing. Maybe it wasn't just them. Maybe the problem was there already, but they haven't improved it. And that's a problem. And we want to welcome these people. We want to live in countries where we welcome people who can't live in their homeland anymore. But we can't welcome them if we don't have anywhere for them to live and, you know, communities to belong to. So, you know, it there's a whole lot of things that also need to happen around that.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. I mean, I think it's one of those things where there needs to be the system needs to be set up and to be able to take people on board. It's great that the community of Wellington and others are sort of, you know, helping, but it is something that needs to be done at a country level. And obviously it's the problems created at a country level as well. Let's move to this one from the Catholic News Service. Polarization across society has prompted the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops to launch an initiative that looks to bring people together to serve the common good, called Civilize It, A Better Kind of Politics. The initiative is designed to, quote, move forward the kind of conversations that we need to be having to overcome our divisions, said Jill Rohr, who's the Director of Education and Outreach at the USCCB's Department of Justice, Peace and Human Development, which is coordinating the effort. The effort draws heavily from the teachings of Pope Francis, particularly his call in the third encyclical of his papacy, Fratelli Tutti, on fraternity and social friendship. Quote, we are in a situation where both in society and the church, we are experiencing a lot of division and polarization, Ms. Rohr said. In Fratelli Tutti, Pope Francis specifically is calling Catholics and all people of goodwill to build a better kind of politics, one at the service of the common good. Pope Francis is very clear in Fratelli Tutti that the bishops have been clear in the document, forming consciences for faithful citizenship, that we are called to engage in the public sphere and do so year-round, to be working together and to try to identify ways to work for the common good, Ms. Rao said. The initiative builds on a program with a similar name introduced by the USCCB's Department of Justice, Peace and Human Development for the 2020 election cycle. That effort sought to remind people that civility in political discussions, not rancor, is a virtue. Not a virtue that I would say is probably that common in modern political discourse, Gavin. No,
that was editorializing, was it?
Oh, sorry. Was that not the quote? Sorry, the quote ended. Do you think that is a quality that is common in modern political discourse, Gavin?
I do not, James.
What do you make of this, mate? This so the USCCB coming up with a similar to what they did in 2020, and Civilize It, spelt with a Z, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Calling for a better kind of politics. What do you reckon, mate? What do you think? Good idea? Bad idea? Something's going to happen? You know, where are you at?
Good idea. Unlikely to succeed, probably be what I would say. That doesn't mean that the attempt shouldn't be made. I think our world has, and politics is, I don't know if politics is the worst example of humanity and its engagement with one another, because there are plenty of topics that create this division. But politics, and again, the US is far more polarized than certainly any other country I can think of in the Anglophone world. There is a great mountain to climb to try and create this sort of harmony, or this ability to have rational debates has just left for some reason. And I don't think there's any coincidence that social media has been part of it. I mean, gone through periods in the last 12 months when spending time on social media was just a terrible idea, given some of the nonsense that was being spouted. Again, if we look at the US context on both sides, really, some of the information being shared and some of the accusations being made. It's a very difficult space for people to work in, and you wonder what sort of people are being attracted to this sort of what used to be, you know, a high calling in life. And I think from observing politicians across a number of countries, the statesman-like qualities of leaders of the past are rarely on display, if at all. And to try and bring about this civilized discourse that the bishops rightly call for, I don't see how that's going to happen in the current environment. And as I say, social media has probably got a big part to play in getting us to where we are at the moment, where people can't have a rational debate about so many things in society. And we were always looking, I think we've spoken about this before, but we're constantly trying to find who our enemy is.
Mm.
And the discourse in US politics is absolutely that. And I think I already said, you know, who is my brother on the show earlier, thinking about those in Afghanistan, that there isn't that sense of fraternity and solidarity in so many political pockets around, again, the English-speaking world, which we would know best. So bishops have a responsibility and a duty to call for certain things and to try and be the change, to use an overused cliche. But, you know, some might make the point that the US bishops themselves have expressed a fair bit of rancor, to use a word from the document, themselves in recent weeks and months and years. So,
it's basically been a bit of a war of attrition of words, really. I mean, it's when you sort of look back, even 60, 70 years ago, and sort of watch some of the statesmanship back then, but statespersonship. Anna, you know, that you'd sort of look to leaders and those involved in political discourse to at least have some level of, I don't know if you say respect for your opponent, it's probably not respect, but people have always differed. There's always been division, but it's this polarization piece, right? Going to the extremes that I think is the thing that we're trying to deal with and that the bishops are referring to here. What are your thoughts? What do you think, what's some of the solution to the problem, Anna?
Oof, man. I mean, you know, maybe I don't feel as sort of pessimistic as Gavin, but I mean, you know, I have heard, you know, on podcasts and things like that, you know, people who, you know, maybe different points of view get together and have good debates about things. And I sort of feel like if all those people can get together, like the people within our church who just really want to foster an environment where differences aren't the thing that are sort of that differences are okay, and we want to understand the other person. It is respect, I think, you know, it's a respect for the dignity of the other person, even if you don't agree with them. Like we used to talk about, remember, tolerance was always the big word, and it was harped on about ad nauseum, but we knew that the tolerance wasn't really genuine, because it was really only the tolerance only went one way. You had to the tolerance of this way of thinking and not ours. But yeah, and in everything, I just feel like if there are people from, you know, people who are in politics, people who are in churches, people who are in academia, people who just have, you know, something to say, but who want to say it in a way, you know, like want to engage with other people and get to the bottom of it. You know, it would be great to bring all those people together, because part of it is just modeling how it goes. It's showing how a conversation can work. And also perhaps, I don't know, I think a lot of it is a problem with pride and a problem with thinking that you have all the answers, right? So you're not really willing to listen to the other person, and you're not even just listen to them, but you can't even engage with them. You just have to change your mind to mine, and to somehow kind of that needs to be kind of brought out into the open and exposed, maybe. But yeah, I was having a flick through Facebook. I hardly go on Facebook anymore because it's just, I just found myself becoming very disheartened with what I saw on my newsfeed. And even then, like, I was just looking at a discussion on a group that I follow. And, you know, someone was trying to say, let's not talk about this, have discussions about this particular topic anymore because, you know, like, we can't seem to have a proper discussion. You know, like, there's always, you know, it always ends up being a massive argument or whatever. And I'm like, we can't just go, oh, well, we're not going to talk about that anymore. Like, that's just not, that's not the way that we need to address it. But in fact, maybe what we should do is, before we enter into a discussion on that particular topic, is to examine yourself. Well, how do I contribute to the disintegration of this discussion? Maybe I don't have to, you know, enter into it or engage with it. Maybe I just wait and see what other people say. You know, I don't know. Like, there's just, it feels like, you know, we just don't really ever learn our lesson about how to do it.
I think learning the lesson, maybe that's the thing. I wonder if there's some re-education that's required, Don. Do people just need to be taught how to have a conversation with people that you disagree with without, you know, disassembling them as a person and generally contributing to the decline of society at large? I don't know. That's probably not as catchy a title as Civilize It. But I don't know. What do you make of this, Don?
I think let's put the blame where the blame lies, and that's the liberal left. Basically, in society today, you don't have right-wingers running around saying, you know, people with socialist-type beliefs should have their books burned or lose their livelihoods or be cancelled. But you certainly have that from the left. So you have numerous examples of CEOs, because they made a particular wrong political donation, being removed from their jobs. You have sports people who quote biblical quotes and don't toe the line in terms of the secular ideology of, you know, celebration of LGBT lifestyles, and they should be cancelled and lose their livelihoods and shouldn't be able to play in the sports that they love. And you don't see that attitude from the right. You see a lot of that attitude from the illiberal left, because they're the ones with the power and the institutions and the corporations on their side and the media on their side. And, you know, the media have some play, like, the media have always been left leaning in terms of the kind of makeup of the types of people who are attracted to that particular profession. But the those of the past have been, you know, basically unbiased in terms of their reporting. But you cannot see anything in mainstream media these days that doesn't resemble an opinion piece. And same with, you know, late night comedy. You know, late night comedy used to be an absolute kind of relaxation time where you could basically listen to stand up from, you know, these people, funny people from the US, and now it's basically a political left-wing talk fest. So yeah, I think the liberal left have a lot to answer for. They're the ones with the institutional power, and they're the ones setting the standard in terms of the divisions that we're seeing in society. And I think more people basically need to stand up against it, even people with left-leaning views. Hopefully there's still some liberals on that left side who believe in free speech and believe that the power of, you know, the freedom of speech and the best way to counter our ideas is for ideas to clash rather than running around going, you know, certain ideas need to be cancelled or basically censored from society.
I think, I mean, yeah, there's a lot in there, but I do think that the point around not being able to have an exchange of ideas without one side demonizing the other or saying the other that the ideas are hate speech or that the ideas are dangerous. Or, you know, I think that's one of the things that I'm probably most concerned about. That, and I say again, we've always been divided as a species, but it's the polarization, it's the holding on to the extremes that I think is really what's causing the problem here.
And I think too, excuse me, James.
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
When you say that, when in your head or whatever you say is all about that the problem is with the other person and the problem is never with me, that is the problem. Like, yes, there might be, you know, problems with someone on the other side of the political spectrum or someone on the other side of the aisle in church or whatever. But when you lay all the problems at their feet and not at your own, I think that's the whole problem with us not being able to communicate properly.
Yeah, I think that is definitely part of it, right? Because at that point, you are it's the whole, you know, playing the person, not the ball, and looking at it in the context of is not everything I'm holding on is right. It's like everyone else has an accent, not me. I don't have an accent. I don't know what you're talking about. And it's there is definitely an element of that. There's also, I think, the amplification and the go back to the polarization, the forces that are pulling us apart seem to get stronger and stronger. And at least it used to be, you watch some of the great debates in history or you read through them and there was an element of sport about it almost. You know, congratulations afterwards, not like, okay, sometimes it ended with like a stabbing in the forum. But generally speaking, you had a sense of something bigger than yourself, that there's more that binds us than separates us. And I think that, you know, good on the Conference of Bishops if they've got some practical ideas in there. I think that education, teaching the younger generation coming through, not to make the same mistakes of the older ones, and definitely not looking to them as role models, that's for sure. And resetting the expectations of what good discussion is, that civility in political discussions, not rancor, is a virtue. I tell you what is also a virtue is taking a bit of time out when you're the Pope. And if you can't play in, like, I don't know, basketball, which is the only true sport, as we all know, then you can try something else. How about some foosball? This is from the Associated Press. Pope Francis has received dozens of soccer jerseys and game balls during his 8-year pontificate. 8 years, wow. But he got a new football-themed toy in August, his very own foosball table. Francis played around on the table that was presented to him at the end of his general audience by representatives of a Tuscany-based table football association, Sport Toscana Calciano Balila in Alto Payasco. Pesco.
Exactly.
Just say it
Calcio.
With... What's the last one?
Anyway, calcio.
Calcio.
That's football in Italian.
Oh, calcio. What's Alto Pasco? Pasco? Pacho? Okay. Pacho. Let's go with that. The mayor, Sara D'Ambrosio, wrote on Facebook that the table was designed to be inclusive and work well for people with physical disabilities to encourage their participation in sport. The Argentine-born Pope is a well-known lover of soccer and would probably love the fact that the Associated Press is calling it soccer, and has beloved San Lorenzo Soccer Club in Buenos Aires. He has a long promoted sport as a way to promote solidarity and inclusion, especially for young people. I'm quite keen to have a look at this foosball table, because I've got to tell you, every time I've played foosball, you get right into it, and then you're like, your forearms are really sore and your wrists are sore, and you're sort of, you know, by the end of it, I don't know, I feel like more injured than if I actually went out and played a game of football. But if the Pope, you know, he's a sprightly young, how old is he now?
84? Is he?
Yeah. If he's in there getting in and playing.
No, how old is that, I think?
Bit of foosball and thing. Do you think they like, you know, I don't know, put like saints' names on the back of the jerseys or something on the little players?
Oh, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
branding opportunity missed if they didn't.
Yeah. 84 for the record.
Are you partial to a bit of foosball, Don?
Yeah, I used to have a table. It just reminded me of my table, but I don't have it anymore. If anyone knows where it is.
If anyone knows where it is, they can write in. Send us an email. There you go, if you know where Don's foosball
table
is.
Did you have it sitting in a new carport or something, Don, and someone nicked it one night?
No, I think I left it at someone's someone's house. I think they moved to Australia. So, yeah.
Well,
not me, that was about 20 years ago.
I mean, I'm not sure foosball tables count as an essential item, Don. You might be able to get one contactlessly delivered to you.
I'd rather have the K-Fry.
Well, if you out there in 15th Station Land, if you know where Don's foosball table is and you want to send him an email telling him, feel free to send him an email about that or about anything we've talked about on the podcast. You can reach out to us at podcast@station15.co.nz or feedback@station15.co.nz. I really have got to write that down, Gavin. I switch the email address every episode. And if you don't believe me, you can go back and listen to our previous episodes. They're all available to download at www.station15.co.nz. You can also subscribe there, or you can subscribe in Spotify or Google Podcasts or iTunes or wherever you find your podcast. You should be able to find the 15th Station. Just search for us. If you're using a podcatcher of choice and we're not there, send us a note and let us know, or reach out at twitter.com/station15 or facebook.com/station15, and we'll definitely look into it and make sure we make it available for your listening pleasure. Really just leaves me just to thank you Don for making the time, mate. Always good to talk to you.
Likewise, thanks James.
Thanks for dialing in from lockdown, really appreciate it. And thanks for calling in from your version of a lockdown. I guess it's kind of a lockdown, of course it is. Anna, thank you very much for making the time.
Well, I've got nothing else to do, James. So. It's
good... Oh, wow.
You can go to the drive-thru at K-Fry.
Wow, actually, do that.
You should do that, and then you should send it to Don. That's right, that's right. And thank you, Gavin. Always good to talk to you, buddy.
Thank you, James. Stay safe.
Yes, indeed. You too. And all of you out there, we hope for all our New Zealand-based listeners, we hope you're doing okay. For the Auckland listeners, hang in there. And for our Australian listeners, you hang in there as well. Everyone, in fact, I could just say that pretty much for everyone. I think most parts of this part of the world are facing a form of lockdown. Ironically, as it seems like a lot of the Northern Hemisphere is starting to open up. So to all our listeners up there, we wish you the very best, and we're praying for everyone at this time. And a good opportunity maybe not just to include people in your prayers, but actually to reach out and just check and see how people are doing. It's definitely tough for some, where I think everyone's heard the phrase by now that we're all in the same storm but just in very different boats. So it's good to sort of check in and see how your fellow sailors are doing. If you want to check in with us again, we'll be back again next month. Until then, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.